How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself? How will you disrupt yourself?
Welcome to the Disrupt Yourself podcast. I'm Whitney Johnson. I think, write, speak, and live all things disruption. In anticipation of the re-release of my book, Disrupt Yourself, with Harvard Business Press, available for pre-order now at whitneyjohnson.com/disrupt, we are continuing our look at the 7-point framework of personal disruption. Today, our interview focuses on accelerant number 7, be driven by discovery. As you take the right risks and play where no one else is playing, you'll quickly find that you're figuring things out as you go. You're blazing a new trail, a new path. You'll need to pivot as new data emerges. It's okay to end up in a place you didn't expect. To illustrate this accelerant, we're talking to Eric Schoenberg. Eric is the CEO of Mansueto Ventures, the media holding company that is home to Inc. and Fast Company magazines. Prior to becoming CEO, Eric was the president and editor-in-chief of Inc.
Eric Schoenberg, I am so delighted to be interviewing you today. Welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here, Whitney.
Very first question for you is, where did you grow up and what did you want to be when you grew up?
I grew up in a suburb right outside Cincinnati, Ohio. And when I was asked that question in first grade, it was the first time really I remember being asked. It was in a classroom. In the Catholic school that I attended, the nun asked everyone in the class what they wanted to be when they grew up, and everybody knew what the right answer was. All the girls said they wanted to be nuns, and all the boys said they wanted to be priests, with one exception of a guy who wanted to be a policeman. But I hedged my bets and said that, of course, I wanted to be a priest, but first, I wanted to be a fighter pilot. So I was already bargaining with God, and that dream to be a fighter pilot went away. The priest thing ended pretty much for everybody as soon as I got out of that nun's classroom. As I got into college, I really fell in love with the theater. So I don't know if anyone can say they want to be an actor when they grow up, because not growing up is kind of essential to that career choice. But that's what I did. When I left college, I went into show business for about 6 years and then decided I really did need to grow up and get another job.
So did you study acting in college, or what did you study in college?
Yeah, I was a theater arts major, which meant there was a little bit of acting going on, a little bit of practical instruction, but mainly it meant I read a lot of plays. It was a literary course as much as anything else.
So, Eric, what was your favorite role to play as an actor? What was your favorite part ever?
My favorite part ever was to play the boy in a play called Equus, which was a very big play in the 80s and was revived on Broadway relatively recently, about 5 or 6 years ago, with Daniel Radcliffe, the Harry Potter star, in the lead role. And I saw the play when I was on a study abroad program in London. So it was an English play, and it was done on the West End, you know, big Broadway stage there. And I said, I want to play that role. And it's not that often that the things that you want to have happen in show business. But eventually I did get that role.
Wow. Okay. And so were you off Broadway or on Broadway in that play?
In that play, I played in a regional theater in Milwaukee.
Okay, got it.
The other good thing about the play was that the boy has a girlfriend, and that actress ended up as my wife. We were married for 35 years.
That is so sweet. So she was in the play with you.
That's right.
Oh, okay. So acting did bear fruit for you.
Exactly. Yeah. So you can't say I came away with nothing from show business. As a matter of fact, not only did I get a wife out of that play, but I also got one of the best cute meet stories of all time. And maybe you've heard this before, because our mentor, Marshall Goldsmith, usually wheedles it out of me whenever he introduces me to someone. But Equus, for those of you who are familiar with plays that were popular in the 80s, has a nude scene in it. And the nude scene is between the boy that I played and the girl that my wife-to-be played. So it gave me the opportunity to say that I met my wife First time I saw her, we were naked across the stage, and it was love at first sight.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Wow. Okay. You did acting for 6 years. You met your wife. You had some really great experiences. And then you had a moment where you realized you weren't going to be an actor. Do you remember when that was?
Yeah, a couple of things came together. One was that I was starting to have some success in showbiz, and I was working a lot in regional theaters, New Brunswick, New Jersey, Pittsburgh Public Theater, the Philadelphia Annenberg Center, and things like that. And I began to see what the life was really like.
Hmm.
And it wasn't what I wanted. It was too much of a gypsy life, and I wanted to have a more conventional life with a family and a career that had a more of a through line to it, more of a sense of progress. And so I decided it was time for us to go. And my wife remained in acting, so you know, we still had one foot in the theater, and you could say that our household was not big enough for two actors. And so one of us had to go, and the better actor stayed in the business.
So throughout her life, she stayed in acting.
That's right.
So you realized that this was not, the actor's life was not for you. And then you decided to go in and get a job, another kind of job, because obviously you got paid to do that. But what was your first job, ex-acting, and how did you get that job?
I noticed in show business that the people who had a leg up in getting hired were people who were part of an old boy network. And they had gone to Yale Drama School or Juilliard or something like that. And so when I decided that I should get into publishing, I looked around and said, so where's the network there that I can get into by going to school? And after some investigation, it appeared that my best choice and most efficient choice would be to go to something called the Publishing Procedures Course, which was taught at that time at Radcliffe College. So I went there, and it was indeed kind of a meat market for young talent. Professionals from New York or Boston would come to Radcliffe and lecture, and then people who did good homework for them would come away with job offers, and that's what happened to me. So I ended up at Time Life Books, which was an offshoot of the biggest magazine company in the world at the time, Time Life.
Mm-hmm.
And the Time Life Books was a lot like a magazine business. A new book in a series would be published every 6 weeks or so. And there were a number of series that I worked on. But the first job I had was a science series aimed at teenagers. And that was fascinating and a great way to be introduced to what was really cool about being a journalist, which is the ability to learn something new every month.
Hmm. So, Eric, when did you realize that you could write? Had you written a lot in college? Because, I mean, you come out of it, you're like, I'm not going to be an actor anymore. I understand that in order to get a job that I want, I need to figure out where the networks are. And so you did that sleuthing. You figured out, let's go to Radcliffe. But how did you know you wanted to do something writing related?
All through school, people had told me I was a pretty good writer. That's what I thought. Well, this is a talent I can exploit, I hope.
Mm-hmm.
And turned out to be right.
I remember listening to you do an interview and you talked about doing fact checking.
Yes. Okay. Yes. My first employment was at Time Life Books at the science series for kids where I did everything. And when I finally transitioned from Time Life Books to magazines, I came in as a fact checker at Money Magazine.
Oh, okay.
So that was a job, few of which still exist anymore, but it was the entry-level job for journalists in those days. And you took a story that someone else had written. You recalled all the sources that writer had used,
mm-hmm.
you know, live sources and documentary sources, and checked that what that writer said was correct. And basically by retracing the steps of a more experienced journalist, you learned how the craft was done. It was a great way to learn.
Hmm.
So from fact checker, the career ladder was to go to writer. You check facts and you can essentially audition for the role of writer by writing files for the writer who would eventually be byline.
Hmm.
So you do the research, you write a file, And the writer, if they're a generous person, would say that this was really well written and alert editors at the magazine that this reporter or fact checker seems to have some writing talent and ought to be given some small jobs. And that's how it went for me. I remember writing a file about a story on how to sell your house for a talented writer named Diane Harris, who later became the editor-in-chief of Money, and a good friend of mine. And she immediately praised me to the editor who she reported to. And out of that came my first assignments.
Mm. So it was her generosity that really made a difference for you early
absolutely.
On.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. Does she know that? Have you told her that?
No, I don't think I ever talked to her about it specifically, but she knows it. She definitely knows it. And I was able to pay her back when I became the editor-in-chief of Money, and she had been out of the business for a while. I hired her back as my deputy. And after I left Money, she became the editor-in-chief.
Wow, what a lovely pas de deux.
Yes, it was, wasn't it?
Yeah, that really is. Okay. All right. So you did Time Life, you went to Money Magazine. Then what did you do after that?
From Money, I went to CBS Interactive and started a website for CBS called CBS Money Watch.
Mm-hmm.
And from there, landed at Inc. as the editor of the website, Inc.com. I got that job the way most people do, through networking. Some of the writers who had written for me at Money Watch were also writers at Inc. and let the person who was the president of Inc. at the time know that I was in the market when he had a role to fill at Inc.com. I got the job, and that was 8 years ago. So from the website at Inc.com, I became the editor of both the website and the magazine, and eventually the president of the magazine, and eventually the CEO of both titles that are owned by the holding company, Mansueto Ventures, both Inc., and its sister, Fast Company.
Okay, so we're going to talk about those in just a minute, because that's quite a meteoric rise. Okay, so I have to just comment really quickly. I was doing some sleuthing, and you wrote this fun piece that I want to just read, because I think it's a piece that online, and here's what you wrote. It's about if the market drops precipitously, which everyone thinks it's going to. So when the Dow drops significantly, your stomach tightens, your palms sweat, and you begin to envision yourself living your last days in a cardboard box. Do you remember writing this?
No, okay. But it sounds great. Keep going.
Yeah, I'll keep going. With those thoughts dancing in your head, you can do one of two things. You can give into the panic and make an emotional decision, which you will probably regret, or you can do something constructive with your time. And here's the very first thing you say to do, which I just love. Number one, go into your bathroom and grasp the edges of the sink with both hands, look deeply into the mirror and repeat three times, I was ready for this. I can handle this. Why do you say this? Because bear markets are the price you pay when you invest in equities and angle for return that you expect to be higher than bonds. Do you remember it now?
Yes.
It's so clever. And as a person who's, you know, been an equity analyst and also having invested, I remember especially 2008 where I did something akin to this, but I just think it's so clever the way you just try to get people, like get a grip, people. This is something you knew was part of the bargain.
Yes. This is what you signed up for.
Yeah. So Eric, were you surprised when you started to really enjoy writing about money? Like, is that something you expected to really take to?
I had a moment as the editor of Inc. in which I had a financial conference to attend, which happened to be in New Brunswick, New Jersey, which was down the street from the old theater where I had once worked. So I took a quick break from the rubber chicken dinner and walked down to the theater. And I don't know if this has ever happened to you, Whitney, but I was absolutely gripped by laughter. And it was a kind of philosophical laughter. It was like, how on earth did I get from there, that theater, the George Street Theater, to this financial conference? It seemed so improbable. And if you had told the actor, Eric, on stage playing an emotionally disturbed Cockney kid. That he would be the editor-in-chief of a financial magazine, he would have thought you were totally crazy.
That's so great. Keep going.
Anything that is challenging, worth doing, and that has the potential to make life better for people and that requires mastery can be turned into an interesting topic to write about. And the thing about money is that it's not just how do you get 25 more basis points return on your bond fund. It's about the psychology of how you handle yourself as an investor, how you value money as a person, and what you intend to do with it. And it really gets down very quickly to your values and your character. And that kind of is what I began to write about. And Money Magazine, I told my people, is not about Wall Street. And it's not about analyzing mutual funds. It's about helping people realize their dreams and helping people manage their emotions, even if that means ripping the edge of the sink and screaming into the mirror. And it's about coming to grips with their values. So the mission of Money was not, as I tried to explain it to the staff, was not about making people richer. It's about making them happier.
I love that. You know, it's something that I've thought a lot about over the last couple of years as we've had, you know, lots of, well, you didn't know this, but I'm telling you, we had lots of ups and downs financially and really looking at how we feel about money and what our relationship with money is, and then doing some family history and discovering that we've had a number of people going back several generations who ended up in the poorhouse, and how there are all these really interesting patterns around it and our relationship with it. And I think it's just fascinating to hear you talk about this and really trying to get people to go to the psychological aspect of it. And it's actually a very, very deep topic. And oftentimes people are less or more reluctant to talk about money than they are relationships. It's like one of the biggest taboos out there. And so it's just fascinating that you discovered this interesting angle for into the human psyche and the human experience through money, and probably quite unexpected, I suspect.
Jack Bogle, who recently died, he was the founder of the Vanguard Mutual Fund Company, which is now a huge financial institution, but was uniquely positioned as one of the most ethical players in the market, and rightly so. And Bogle, in his book about money, introduces it with a story about Joseph Heller, the novelist who wrote Catch-22, among other books. And Heller is at a party in some rich enclave on Nantucket, and he is introduced to a hedge fund manager. And after the hedge fund manager leaves, the person who did the introduction says, "That man has more money than you will ever see in your life, Mr. Heller." And he says, "Yes, but I have something that he will never have, and that is enough." Recognizing what is enough is a real key to having a healthy relationship with money.
That's good. What's the book that you're referring to?
The book is called Enough.
Oh.
It's by Jack Bogle.
Okay. It's called Enough. Well, there you go. Okay. So you leave money, you go to Inc. Talk to us about how you landed there.
Through networking. What I realized when I landed here very quickly was that the reputation that Inc. had that I had noticed from my career in journalism was that Inc. was a magazine where writing was valued, and it was considered a pioneer when it launched in 1979 as a business niche magazine, and it began a wave of magazines that were not general interest magazines, but magazines for people with really specific interests. And Inc., as you and the listeners may know, is focused entirely on entrepreneurs and founders, or the people who want to become that kind of business person, someone who creates a great business where nothing existed before. And that was, that impression was all true. The novelty of a niche magazine had worn off by the time I got here. But what I was not prepared for was how remarkable the audience of Inc. is. So these are the people who make a free enterprise economy go. They're the people who start things. And my previous experience with business as a editor at a writer and editor at Money was in the public markets. So you're dealing with companies that are giant and that are already decades old for the most part. And when people talk about investors in the stock market being the source of capital for, you know, innovation and free enterprise and so forth, that's not literally true. People who buy stocks on the public markets are contributing to the creation of value and innovation only indirectly by helping to set a price for what equity is worth in a business. But the people who actually cause innovation and create jobs and bring to light breakthroughs in technology and in customer service and products are the entrepreneurs. So suddenly I had gone from being at this arm's length removed from the people who make the economy go to talking to them directly. And at Inc. events, meeting them face to face. It was a weird change from writing about people who were sort of godlike investors and had returns that my readers at Money Magazine could not aspire to and shouldn't aspire to being at a publication where the people you wrote about were also the people who were likely to read the publication and where the people who read the publication had a real experience of learning things from the publication that helped make them successful. So when you met people from Inc. and Inc. events, you realize they love this publication. They think that we helped make them rich, and they may well be right, that we maybe gave them information that made a difference in how they ran their business. But even more importantly, we made them feel like they were part of a fraternity of really brave and innovative people and part of a movement that was really important to free enterprise and helped them get through the really tough times that every entrepreneur faces. So we gave them I hope, and still give them, stories that inspire them to keep going when things get rough, as they always do for small businesses.
You know what, Eric? I feel that. When I read your magazine, I do feel that. I have that experience. There's this feeling of camaraderie and this feeling of community. And I can absolutely sense that what you're saying, I know that you know this from all your research, but that it is really a magazine where people go to learn from and develop and grow and also to find their tribes. So yeah, I feel that. And so my question to you is, how does it feel to you that you get to be a part of this?
Oh, it's great. When I landed here and realized what was special about Inc., I thought, my God, where have I been my whole career? Wall Street is fine and intellectually challenging, and the people who succeed there are very smart and well-connected and always very well-dressed. But entrepreneurs are where it happens. And the stories that they have to tell that we get to frame for them as writers are just so much more interesting and so much more important. And I just felt like, wow, I have arrived.
Yeah, so you have this interesting bird's eye view now of entrepreneurs. I mean, you're constantly scanning the environment. And I remember hearing you talk, I have two questions for you. Number one is, how does someone become an Inc. 5000 honoree? Because I think we have some people listening who are like, I want to be a part of that club. So what does that look like and how do I do that? So that's my first question. But then the second one is, I remember hearing you say that you had done a survey with Gallup and looking at what kind of distinguishing traits the entrepreneurs had that are on your list. And I would love for you to talk about that so that people can be thinking about, okay, do I have these traits? And if I don't, how do I get more of them? So love to have you kind of riff on those different questions for a moment.
Okay. The answer to the first question about how you get on the Inc. 5000 is you build a company that grows rapidly. The Inc. 5000 is a strictly quantitative ranking. You know, I hate to say it, but you can't get on the Inc. 5000 by taking an editor out to lunch or sending them mash notes by email.
That's a good thing.
It is a good thing. It is a good thing, except for my lunch budget.
a lot of people taking you out to lunch.
I would like to say I never have to pay for lunch, but that's not true. The Inc. 5000 is strictly by the numbers. It's all your company's growth rate over 3 years.
Okay.
And that's it. And you have to verify it. Companies that you apply, mm-hmm. let us know. And you have to, you can't just tell us what the numbers are. You have to verify it by showing us your tax returns or some other method of verification. So okay. it's rigorous and it. Quantitative.
Meritocracy for the win. We love it.
Yeah, that's right. It is. When you get on the Inc. 5000, you know that everyone else on it got there fair and square.
Yeah.
And the traits that we found when we had a Gallup survey of Inc. 5000 honorees, which we repeated in last year's Inc. 5000, by the way, and got the same result, there are about 22 different traits that Gallup had decided were important traits to success in business. And, you know, they included salesmanship and networking and other things that you can well imagine. And in most of those categories, the Inc. 5000 honorees performed much better than average business people. But there were three in which they performed extraordinarily better by a factor of 4 or 5 times than average business people. And those were willingness to take risk, business focus, and resilience. So the mnemonic that I use is guts, focus, and grit.
Okay.
Now, about guts, it's obvious why being willing to take risk is a handy attribute for entrepreneurs, but you want to distinguish between reckless risks and calculated risks.
Mm-hmm.
You can't innovate, you can't start a company without putting your finances, your family, your sleep patterns at risk. But entrepreneurs who succeed tend to be very calculated about it and weigh the upside against the risks that they're taking. However, speaking as a journalist, I have to say that the guts part is the part that gives you the best stories, because there's always some near-death experience that entrepreneurs go through that they bounce back from. There's one that I tell a lot, which was one of the first stories I encountered as an editor at Inc. And it just stuck with me. It's a story about a company called J. Hilburn, which was based out of Dallas and made bespoke shirts, which it sold over the internet. The company is still going strong, but it's not by any means a household name. It was founded by a former Wall Street bond trader, and he had done his research and decided this was a market opportunity. But like anyone who goes into a startup situation, things just didn't work out that well. Like the shirts he made, the supplier had been not quite forthright about the quality of the clothing, so they didn't survive a couple of washings, buttons fell off them. And, in the first years of his business, his returns outpaced his revenue, and things were going pretty badly.
His losses were greater than his revenue?
Yeah. Okay. And he was... the bank wanted to foreclose on his house. The private school where his kids were attending was threatening to kick the kids out because he wasn't making his tuition payments. And as all this stuff was coming to a head, he got a call from his old Wall Street firm, and they were offering him a contract. They wanted him back. And they offered him what's called a 3x3 contract, which is a guaranteed $3 million and a 3-year commitment. And he looked at his wife and he said, no. Wow, these are the people I want to write about.
Mm-hmm.
It took guts and confidence in his business model and the sense that he would eventually turn things around. And eventually he did. Money came through. He got a new supplier. The business thrived. And
he made the Inc. 5000.
And he made the Inc. 5000. And he sold eventually to a private equity company.
Wow. Okay, so you talked about these three traits: grit, guts, and focus. Mm-hmm. So, can you talk us through how the Inc. entrepreneurs over-index?
The survey, which was conducted by Gallup, asked a lot of questions that led the Gallup poll takers to conclude that these were characteristics of the poll respondents possessed, and the degree to which they exhibited strength in these things is how the poll was measured. I think it's easier to sort of talk about stories that illustrate the characteristics. In the category of grit, one of the stories is a story about a company called Rebel Athletics. They made and still make uniforms, so performance uniforms for competitive cheerleaders. Now, I had never heard of competitive cheerleading, but in places like Florida and Texas, everybody knows what it is.
It's a thing.
It's a thing. It's an immensely competitive thing. And it's reflected in the incredible athleticism of the people who participate in it, but also reflected in the incredible competitiveness of the companies that provide the uniforms. And Rebel was a challenger in that field. And the way that uniforms are sold is at cheerleading meets. You don't go to a store and buy it. You know, there's a shopping center set up at the meet. And Rebel's incumbent competitor bought the rights to all the meets. So Rebel basically had no outlet to sell its clothes. So what they did, talk about resilience and refusal to be beaten, was that they went to the meet in a tractor trailer with a big trailer, and the trailer became their storefront parked outside the meet. Now, the problem with that, the obstacle that they had to overcome to do that, was that wherever this meet was being held, I forget, might have been San Diego. San Diego will not allow you to park that big vehicle on the street outside the meet unless you're making a movie. So Rebel decided that they would make a documentary movie and film it partly out of this tractor trailer, which also housed all their goods on display. And the movie, by the way, was about how to defend yourself against bullies.
Wow, what a great story. So that's grit.
That's grit.
Love it. Okay. So in the interest of time, I'm going to move on, but those are amazing stories of guts and grit. And maybe we can include in the show notes a story of focus for people, but wow, that's so good. Okay. All right. So question for you is, how does one move from being the editor to the CEO or publisher? I mean, those are really different jobs, right?
They're very different jobs. And it's a unusual path for someone to take. Usually a CEO comes up from the business side, was either a publisher, salesman, circulation director, or something like that. In this case, the owner of Mansueto Ventures, Joe Mansueto, who's the founder of Morningstar, the independent financial analysis firm, liked the idea of having an editor be the person in charge. Whoever was the CEO of Mansueto Ventures would still be in charge of the editorial side, of course. So as Joe saw it, it simply sent a message about his belief in the quality of the product and the journalism. And he had faith that I would learn the business side. And I hope I've proved him right.
So what's been the biggest surprise for you in terms of moving to the business side? That like, oh, I didn't expect I was going to need to learn how to do X.
I think the biggest change in me was getting over all the prejudices I had from being siloed as an editor for all those decades as an editor and writer. And there's an immense amount of creativity going on the sales and digital promotion and marketing side of the business that I find remarkable and admirable. And I'm so sorry that I was so arrogant as an editor, thinking that we were the creatives and they were the people on the business side were not. That was definitely not an honest or informed idea of where the talent lay in the business. It is evenly distributed on both sides of the aisle.
Interesting. So just appreciating it's sort of the gamekeeper turned poacher. You just completely appreciate something, walk in that person's shoes, unexpected, fascinating. Yes. So a very wise person once said, upon losing his job, I've seen better days. The first salvo of this restructuring is now public, and the salvo hit me right in the chest. So at one point you lost your job, and I have this really hypothesis, and I want you to talk for just a minute, this, that sometimes we lose our jobs, because I've lost my job as well, been fired. And I have this hypothesis that that happens because we're at the top of our learning curve and it's time for us to go. And we knew it, but we wouldn't go. And so the universe gave us a little nudge. And so I don't know if that jives with your experience, but and if it does, would love to hear or not. But I'd also love to hear from you, what would not have happened for you in your life as of today had you not lost that job?
Oh, my gosh, Whitney. The way you characterize it is so apt. I would never have become web savvy if I hadn't lost my job at the top of a magazine. I would have ridden the sinking ship that was Time Inc. Through much, much tougher days than I saw. I was correct in describing what was happening as the first salvo of a restructuring that eventually brought Time Inc. to the edge of dissolution. And so I got out at a good time. And I would never have ended up where I am now, serving entrepreneurs who are, you know, fascinating to write about and very worthy of help. So much would not have happened to me. It was really, at the time, I was, you know, brokenhearted and embarrassed and all the negative emotions that come from being fired, but it was the best thing that happened to me.
So this wasn't money, right? Yeah, it's so fascinating because I'm going to guess, and I think this actually could be a really fun article, although you've probably done it already, is like find out how many of your entrepreneurs actually became entrepreneurs after they had lost a job, either been laid off or fired. I think it'd be super interesting to do some kind of study around that. So if you want to talk about it, let's talk about it. But I just think it's a fascinating thing because so many good things come out of that moment of being in the nadir. And then you rebuild your life and there are these wonderful, wonderful things that happen as a consequence.
I would certainly say that every entrepreneur goes through some hardship, some moments where they have to face the reality that they screwed up, that their something that they did was very wrong, and they have to distance themselves personally from that mistake, realize that that's not them, that doesn't define them, and it's just an opportunity to grow. Every entrepreneur, I think, has that mindset. In the Gallup survey that we were talking about, it registered as grit, resilience, determination, but I think it's also sometimes defined as a growth mindset, where you see setbacks as opportunities and not defining shortcomings in your own makeup.
Yeah. Such an important distinction. I think that's, yeah, and very important. Okay, so as we start to wrap up, there was an essay that you wrote in a compilation of essays by Marshall Goldsmith and Frances Hesselbein and Sarah MacArthur, and it was something that you wrote about George Washington. And I would love it if you could just share that story briefly and some of what you've learned from that story.
Well, thanks, Whitney. The challenge that we were asked to meet in writing these essays was to look out your window and see what you saw in a figurative way. And so it happened that my window, my office window, looks out over the Hudson River, and up the Hudson River is the George Washington Bridge. The George Washington Bridge is kind of ironically named because it commemorates not one of Washington's great triumphs, but one of his worst disasters, the thing that he probably least wants to be remembered for. But the bridge connects Fort Washington and Fort Lee, which are called forts because that's what they were during the Revolutionary War. Fort Washington on the Manhattan side of the river was the last foothold of the Patriots in the Revolutionary War. And they had, with George Washington as their general, had been beaten up one defeat after another, one humiliating defeat after another, by the more disciplined British and Hessian troops, and basically chased off the island of Manhattan. Their last foothold was Fort Washington. It was on a promontory. It was a defensible position, perhaps with better troops. George Washington's favorite lieutenant was a general named Nathanael Greene, and he urged Washington to hold on to Fort Washington, that it was defensible. Okay. And so Washington listened to his second in command. And when the Hessians finally attacked Fort Washington, the Patriot troops held out for about an hour and a half and then were routed, and many of them were executed by the Hessians because they were rebels. So Washington, watching from across the river, having been evacuated by boat from Manhattan, having lost the last foothold in New York, and then watching his troops be executed, was at the lowest point of his career as a general. And legend has it that it was the one time that people saw Washington cry. His troubles weren't over either, because with the defeat of Fort Washington, the Patriots abandoned Fort Lee in a panic and retreated through New Jersey with the British and Hessians only a few steps behind them. But what was remarkable was that Washington continued to be a leader, that he positioned himself at the tail end of his troops, so he was closest to the enemy. He led them away and never let the troops see how disconsolate he was. The measure of true leadership. And then, as the history books will record, especially American history books, within a few months, he rallied the troops, crossed the frozen Delaware, surprised those same Hessians who had routed his forces at Fort Washington at the Battle of Trenton, and turned the war completely around.
It's amazing. Lots of thoughts that I have. So here's, as we wrap up, just a few final questions. One is, you have said that you wish that when you were in college, you had sought out people you could learn from more. You had sought out more mentors. And I think I know that you now have sought out mentors. You have a mentor like Marshall Goldsmith. My question to you is, if George Washington were to mentor you from, you know, 300 years ago today, what would he mentor you? What would you be learning from him as you lead your organization, which is by many, many counts, very successful? But how would you allow him to mentor you?
That's a great question. And I actually think about this a lot. One is the lesson from his retreat from Fort Washington, which is to remember that your demeanor is really important, is looked up to by the people who report to you. And the fact that while some of his lieutenants saw him break down, he quickly gathered himself and became the charismatic leader that the American cause needed at that time. The second thing that I learned from him was after the Battle of Trenton, in which he restored the momentum of the revolution, he found himself with his troops camped at Trenton and with the British camped, the British who had rallied to come to Trenton and pay him back for the defeat of their Hessian allies, camped across a creek. Washington was of a mind to defend the ground he held. And the British opposing him were confident that this would be the end of the revolution. And while some people in the British camp were thinking Washington may escape, the general in charge there was unwilling to listen to any of his lieutenants. Washington, on the other hand, pulled together a council of war. The people warned him that it was too big a risk to stand and fight the British, and that someone knew a way around the British lines over a frozen creek. And so that night, while the British were camped planning their attack that would be decisive, Washington and the Americans slipped away around the flank of the British. The British woke up to an empty camp across the creek from them, and the sounds of Washington routing their rear guard at the Battle of Princeton. So Washington was a charismatic leader who exercised self-restraint when needed, but he was always willing to listen to good advice and didn't let his ego get in the way like his British opponent did at that battle.
All right. I think it's fascinating. You know, it's interesting. It's been said in research that 70% of all successful new businesses end up in a different place than where they started. And certainly if I look at you, you've been out of college for, you know, over 25 years. And I'm sure you're successful, but you never could have imagined that you'd end up being the CEO of a holding company for two of the most popular influential magazines for entrepreneurs. It's just fascinating. Okay, so very last question for you, Eric. You have said that when you're writing, even if you're writing about money or entrepreneurship, you're creating a story about happiness, success, security, overcoming fears, or being the steward of your own perception. We've just had a conversation today. And so my question to you is, what is the story that you told in talking to our listeners today?
I would say that it is that you are the master of your destiny, in the sense that you are the master of how you perceive what's happening to you. And that if you can find the opportunity to make the most of the things that seem like setbacks, you will be the master of your destiny and good things will happen. At the same time, it helps to be unwilling to lose. And it helps to remember that the responsibility you have to others.
I love that. Eric Schoenberg, thank you so much for this conversation today.
Whitney, this is a real pleasure. Thank you so much.
Stories like Eric's are fascinating to me. We often hold this linear narrative for success, the child prodigy who goes on to become a concert pianist, or the brilliant wunderkind who becomes the brain surgeon. But the reality is, few of us follow a strictly linear path through life. We meander. Interesting that Eric decided that taking on the competitive risk of being an actor, it wasn't for him. But because of his background in theater, Eric has a deep love of storytelling that led him to writing about the entrepreneurial journey of others at Inc. Theater is also a very collaborative and community-driven experience. So it's interesting that those things have been guiding values for Eric in his current role. And because he's an experienced journalist who respects editorial, he's uniquely positioned to publish this magazine, to manage the business aspects of it. He's perfectly suited to be in the role he currently fills, but it certainly was not a linear path. If your path feels like it's taking you in a million different directions, take heart. Embrace the idea of being discovery-driven. We talked about this a little bit in our episode with Rita McGrath, episode 126. When you don't know what's coming around the corner, instead of becoming paralyzed with uncertainty, know that you can plan to learn. That regardless of where this path takes you, you'll learn skills that will serve you as you continue to play to your distinctive strengths and take on market risk. Practical tip. Take a few minutes this week to consider or write down the answer to this question. How has your life and career been discovery-driven? What lessons did you learn that are serving you in your life and career today? These insights will help you as you continue to make discovery-driven decisions, remembering that if something feels scary and lonely, you're probably on the right path. Finally, my book, Disrupt Yourself, as I mentioned, relaunches next Tuesday, November 12th. That means you have one more week to pre-order and take advantage of the chance to sign up for the special private webinar we're having for everyone who pre-orders the book. This is unlike anything we've done before, and we want you to be a part of it. For more information on how to sign up, please visit whitneyjohnson.com/disrupt. Thank you again to Eric Schoenberg for being our guest. Thank you to sound engineer Whitney Job, manager, editor Macy Robinson, content contributors Emily Davis and Nancy Wilson, and art director Brandon Jameson. I'm Whitney Johnson, and this is Disrupt Yourself.